The 1968 epidemic of confrontations reached from Columbia University on Morningside Heights to the Sorbonne on the Seine. Two scenes 3,000 miles apart that were almost interchangeable as Mark Rudd and Danny the Red demanded student power.
The date, April 23rd, 1968. Acting Dean of Columbia College, Henry S. Coleman, confronts demonstrators in the lobby of Hamilton Hall.
Am I to understand, then, that I'm not allowed to leave this building?
Well, let me ask. Is he to understand that he's not to be to leave this building?
Yeah! Just...
I think the consensus is that you're staying, sir.
800 Columbia students laid siege to Lowe Library and Hamilton Hall to stop the building of a gymnasium in Morningside Park.
At the request of the mayor, and without prejudice to continuation at a later time, we have suspended construction on the gymnasium.
While thousands of students in the Latin Quarter barricaded and closed the Sorbonne for the first time in its 700-year history. The president of the French Republic, Charles de Gaulle, saved only by the working class lack of sympathy with student radicals, suffered serious political wounds that contributed to his downfall a year later.
I think de Gaulle tripped on a pebble, a man who could stride across mountains. It was as though somebody who could walk on water drowned in a puddle. That's the only way I can explain an end of a career of 11 years as the ruler of France on something which only he made to be an issue as great as he made it.
In 1968, 16,511 Americans died in Vietnam, and 83,482 Americans voted for Eldridge Cleaver or Dick Gregory for president. The election, like the entire year, was charged with surprises. Few could have imagined that the two major party candidates would be the men whose presidential aspirations seemed to have ended at John Kennedy's hands in 1960. Hubert Humphrey in the West Virginia primary, Richard Nixon in a close national election. And that they would be challenged by the man who had defied Kennedy's presidential power by standing in the school door at Tuscaloosa. George Wallace, running on an American independent ticket, had become the most formidable third-party candidate since Teddy Roosevelt.
But I want to tell these national parties this. They're going to find out there are a lot of rednecks come November 5th in this country and out in Alabama. They've used us as a doormat long enough. And now we are going to show them that we represent the mainstream of American thought in our country. So, as we move on to talk about other issues, the issue of the breakdown of law and order is today a great issue confronting the American people. And I used to say there's not 10 cents worth of difference in what the Republicans and Democrats say, but recently, some of the things they say are not 10 cents worth of difference in what we are saying now.
George Wallace failed to win enough electoral votes to send the election to the House of Representatives. But almost 10 million Americans, many of them outside the South, voted for him. Hubert Humphrey, after a clumsy start, came on strong in the closing 2 weeks of the campaign.
As president, I would stop the bombing of the North as an acceptable risk for peace, because I believe it could lead to success in the negotiations and thereby shorten the war. Now, if the government of North Vietnam were to show bad faith, I would reserve the right to resume the bombing.
If Saigon had supported Lyndon Johnson's bombing halt and peace negotiations, if the young liberals had supported the Democratic candidate, Humphrey might have won. Richard Milhouse Nixon, in what was the most remarkable comeback in political history, won 43.4% of the national vote to Humphrey's 42.7%. And a mandate to lead a nation divided against itself. His victory statement the morning after took note of this.
I saw many signs in this campaign. Some of them were not friendly. Some were very friendly. But the one that touched me the most was one that I saw in Destler, Ohio, at the end of a long day of whistle stopping. A little town, I suppose five times the population was there in the dusk. It was almost impossible to see, but a teenager held up the sign, "Bring us together." And that will be the great objective of this administration at the outset, to bring the American people together.
The American people and the people of the world did come together for a fleeting instant at Christmas.
All right, you are go for TLI, over.
Roger, understand, we're go for TLI.
And the catalyst was a tiny contraption of aluminum, computerized instruments, and liquid hydrazine called Apollo 8.
We see the Earth now almost as a disk.
We have a beautiful view of Florida now. We can see the Cape just the point.
Roger.
And at the same time, we can see Africa. West Africa is beautiful. I can also see Gibraltar at the same time I'm looking at Florida.
This transmission is coming to you approximately halfway between the moon and the Earth.
We've got it. Apollo 8 now in lunar orbit. There's a cheer in this room. This is Apollo Control Houston, switching now to the voice of Jim Lovell.
Bill, how would you describe the color of the moon from here?
The color of the moon looks a very whitish gray, like dirty beach sand, and with lots of footprints in it.
I think that each one of us carries his own impressions of what he's seen today. I know my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding type existence or expanse of nothing. It looks rather like clouds and clouds of pumice stone.
As the spacecraft flew an elliptical orbit that brought it 69.8 miles above the sunlit portion of the moon, and as a tiny camera sent back to Earth dazzling close-ups of the Sea of Tranquility, the astronauts turned to Genesis.
As God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land Earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.